Trump campaigns in five swing states Sunday in a weekend sprint against challenger Joe Biden just 2 days before the U.S. presidential election. Mr. Trump rallies voters Sunday in toss-up states Michigan, Iowa, North Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, while Biden focuses on Pennsylvania, a key battleground likely to play an important role in Tuesday's election. Candidates campaigned in crucial states in the Midwest and Southeast on Saturday, underscoring the high stakes and the disruptive impact of the coronavirus pandemic. A record 92 million early votes have been cast in what is looking to be the biggest voter turnout in a century. The election takes place in a deeply divided country with feelings so heated that gun sales have surged in some areas. The president of Azerbaijan said Sunday there was no reason for Russia to intervene in the conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh because Baku is not threatening Armenian territory. Fighting has been raging over Karabakh, an ethnic Armenian region of Azerbaijan, for more than a month. And on Saturday, Armenia's prime minister asked Moscow for urgent consultations on how Russia could come to its aid under a defense treaty. Azerbaijan's president said the request was an admission of defeat and that the treaty did not apply because Karabakh is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan. The president reiterated that Azerbaijan has no military plans for Armenian territory. More than 1,200 people from both sides have reportedly been killed in the fighting, but the death toll could be much higher. Fighting erupted on September 27th over Karabakh, which broke from Azerbaijan's control during a war in the 1990s. International attempts to secure a ceasefire have repeatedly failed. This is VOA News. Ivory Coast officials tallied results Sunday after a tense presidential election. There was an opposition boycott and deadly clashes over President Alassane Ouattara's bid for a third term. Scattered unrest, voting material that was vandalized, and some closed polling stations were reported mostly in opposition strongholds during Saturday's vote, although the president had appealed for calm and his party was expecting a win. The latest tensions erupted in August after Ouattara, in power for 10 years, announced he would run for a third term, angering opposition leaders who dismissed it as unconstitutional. Electoral officials have up to 5 days to release the results. Polling stations on Sunday were sending tallies to the Electoral Commission. Ouattara, who is 78 years old, had said after his second term he planned to make way for a new generation, but the sudden death of his chosen successor prompted him to seek a third term. He says a constitutional court ruling approved it, allowing him to reset the country's two-term limit. The tense election took place in a region where Nigeria is experiencing widespread protests, and soldiers in Mali ousted the president while Islamist militants gain a foothold. Turkey on Sunday extended once again a research ship mission in contested waters of the eastern Mediterranean, ignoring Greek warnings that such moves undercut efforts to resolve their dispute. The Turkish Navy said in a message on the International Maritime Alert System, NAVTEX, that their vessel would stay in the area until November 14th. It had previously said the ship would remain until November 4th, which is Wednesday. The latest deployment comes as the two NATO allies have toned down some of their rhetoric in the aftermath of a deadly earthquake that hit both countries. The research vessel, which is escorted by military ships, has become the symbol of Ankara's quest for natural gas in the eastern Mediterranean, where recent discoveries have triggered huge interest and competition. Athens says Ankara is breaking international law by prospecting in Greek waters. Turkey in August sent the ship into the disputed zone, alarming both Cyprus and Greece, which carried out military drills in response. Meantime, residents of Izmir, Turkey, flocked to parks for safety this weekend, staying away from homes damaged in Friday's earthquake in case of more tremors. The earthquake hit western Turkey, killing dozens of people and injuring hundreds more. Rescue operations are continuing amid the rubble. For more on these and other international stories, please visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman for VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and our moderator is Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal.
In the United States, we are in the final days of the 2020 national election. President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden are barnstorming the country, making their closing arguments to an electorate that remains highly polarized and unusually motivated. Early voting has been historic, with tens of millions of Americans already casting their ballots after waiting in line for hours. By the time we return to these microphones in a week, we should know whether Trump has been reelected to a second term or has been ousted by Biden, Barack Obama's vice president for 8 years, or perhaps not. The margins in many so-called battleground states are very narrow. It's entirely possible that a winner may not be known for a few days, and both sides have assembled legions of lawyers prepared to challenge the results on various grounds, including delays by the Postal Service, problems with electronic voting systems, or alleged voter suppression. The COVID-19 virus appears to be overshadowing other issues in the home stretch of this election. Trump contends the country is turning the corner on the pandemic, but new cases and hospitalizations are surging, and medical experts believe within 2 weeks higher death rates will occur. That has raised fears that a second national lockdown of restaurants, bars, and public places may have to be reinstated. In a political victory for President Trump, a deeply divided U.S. Senate confirmed Judge Amy Coney Barrett to be an associate justice on the Supreme Court, cementing a strong conservative majority for perhaps a generation. Justice Barrett is a favorite of many Republicans for her conservative views, and Trump hopes that Barrett will help him politically by energizing his base in the home stretch of the election. In yet another episode of racial unrest, Philadelphia police shot and killed a black man with a knife, sparking violent protests that police said injured 30 officers and led to dozens of arrests. Hundreds of people took to the streets to protest the shooting, with clashes between protesters and police turning violent at times. Well, this election, Linda, is quite like nothing else I think many of us have seen. This seems to me that we've had a four-year campaign, not a one-year campaign. In fact, President Trump announced for re-election early in 2017, not long after he was sworn in. He announced he'd be running again. This reminds me, actually, of October and November of 1976, when Gerald Ford, who was trailing badly to Democratic challenger Jimmy Carter, spent 10 full days on the road, scores of stops around the country without ever returning to Washington. We called him Marathon Man. Well, now Trump and Biden have got busy schedules. President has been up to four events in a single day. Linda, how's he doing in the last week? Is anything out there resonating in President Trump's favor at the moment?
The basic shape of the race really hasn't changed in quite some time. If the polls are to be believed at all, Donald Trump is trailing. He's trailing by significant margin nationally, which of course doesn't count. It's the Electoral College that counts. So it's the key battleground states that we're looking at. So the margin that Trump is ahead by in these key battleground states is bigger than what Hillary Clinton had 4 years ago. I know a lot of people are looking at the polls and looking at what happened 4 years ago and wondering if we're going to see the same thing where it looks like Donald Trump is going to lose and then he wins. This time, there's a little more of a margin. And even if the polls are off, there's a better chance that Joe Biden will win this time than compared with Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. But I can't stress enough how we're in uncharted territory here. We're having a pandemic where our economy is in bad shape, despite the GDP, the growth numbers that just came out, which show strong growth, but that's after a big decline. We have a lot of people voting early. A third of the electorate, I believe, has already voted, and it's still several days before the election. So we just don't know in the end how this will affect the final result. And anybody who says they know what's going to happen is lying.
Both lying, ignorant, and perhaps stupid, or maybe all of the above. I mean, I've said it for years and years. Overnight is a lifetime in politics, and we have at least a few more days worth of lifetimes to go here. Things can often happen, and maybe there will still be more things to happen that even at this late day we don't know about. JJ, what is your sense of your of where this race stands? I agree with Linda that the polls show a steady Biden lead. And I also agree that things are a little bit different this time around. First of all, he was a challenger 4 years ago. This time he's an incumbent with 4 years of good things and bad things for people can judge whether they like what he's done or not. He has a record that he didn't have last time. And also Joe Biden is not as, how shall I put this delicately, hated by many Americans as Hillary Clinton. She was a poster child for the conservative left. Biden, his politics are probably not that much different than Hillary Clinton's, but he's not seen as a hater. He's not a divider. And so there are some differences, but again, anything can happen. So again, JJ, what's your sense of where this race stands today?
Well, Tom, thank you for the question. And as I've mentioned before on this program, I'm not able to comment on political matters and politically framed questions. So I'm going to have to speak from a national security perspective, and I can say that the country is in a very difficult position right now because of, one, all of the disinformation that's taking place, two, all of the overt acts and situations where people are confronting each other. There are situations where people who have been very well respected and revered in the education, in the political, in the intelligence, in the law enforcement community, in the entertainment communities, they're very strong and well-liked people that are, to be quite frank about it, losing it on Twitter, on social media, name calling. And this is precisely what the Kremlin wanted when it started its disinformation campaign many, many, many years ago. It wanted to turn Americans against each other and to force us to doubt our government, electoral and cultural systems. So as far as who wins this, as you both have said, who knows? But what I can say is that one thing that we've already lost is this ability to remain united, to put up a united front. But it can be restored. But right now, we're just in a really difficult national security place.
Well, it is tricky. I mean, Trump is the third president in a row who has not united the country. George W. Bush said, elect me, I'm a uniter, not a divider. That didn't work out. And Barack Obama came in and said, no, I'm a transformational president. I'm a person who can absolutely unite the country. That didn't work out either. And I think it's fair to say that President Trump has worked on polarizing things. So maybe we can hope that a second Trump term will be different, or a first Biden term will be different. We will see. COVID was supposed to go away, according to the president's predictions. It hasn't gone away. President Trump has said the virus would be gone by now. A vaccine would be ready by the election. Neither has happened. And he says on the campaign trail, Linda, that the country is rounding the turn in the battle against this virus. And Vice President Biden says, my grandfather used to say about things like this, he's rounding the bend. So whoever is right, it's pretty clear, I think, that the virus has not gone away. In the last week, there have been 500,000 new cases in the United States. Hospitalizations have jumped almost 10% since last month. More than 70,000 new cases have been reported a day for at least a week, and that is the highest level in history. Moreover, the virus is surging in 35 states, many of them so-called red states that are nominally Republican. How is this affecting the race, Linda? You get the feeling that this at the end?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been the number one issue in the campaign for a long time. And the fact that we're heading toward Election Day amid a terrible surge in the virus, I think just puts a punctuation point on it. And what's striking is the way Trump and Biden are handling this issue and the ways in which they're campaigning. I mean, Donald Trump, as you said, is barnstorming the country, having multiple rallies a day, inviting people, urging people to come to his rallies. He has them at airports and they're outside, but a lot of people aren't wearing masks. They're standing very close to each other and they're risking infection. whereas Joe Biden is not having rallies every day. He's not even having rallies. I mean, he's doing events, but he and Barack Obama are having these car rallies, which are kind of odd. I mean, it's just an odd addition to an odd election cycle where you people come in their cars and then honk their horns when they like something that was said instead of cheering. But to me, it's a form of asymmetrical warfare. Donald Trump is all about generating excitement and enthusiasm around his campaign among his supporters. So these are people who already love him and we're going to vote for him anyway. And he's getting them to turn out in person. And of course, these are also shown on television, if maybe Fox News, the conservative network, or at least on C-SPAN, whereas Joe Biden is running sort of a front porch campaign. Yes, he's traveling and he's going to important battleground states, but not nearly to the extent of Donald Trump. And you can argue that Joe Biden is being the responsible one, not encouraging people to come and stand near each other and not wear masks. You know, the question is, will Trump be rewarded for creating the appearance of enthusiasm while Joe Biden isn't?
I was reminded of something that a press official for President George H.W. Bush said at the end of the 1992 election, after Bush had lost to Bill Clinton. This official said, you know, I don't know how this happened. He said, our crowds were amazing. We'd be out there and they'd be the biggest crowds we'd ever had, the enthusiasm. And he says, you get out there and you get caught up in it and you think there's no way you'd lose, but we lost. Now, I don't know if that's going to be the case here. There's no way to know, but it is true that the crowds, as you say, Linda, Trump's big crowds are, in effect, preaching to the choir. But, JJ, let me ask you to try to put a foreign policy spin on this. France and Germany have recently announced new lockdowns, pretty severe lockdowns. And European medical specialists are claiming, contending, that within a few days, within a few weeks, the United States will have to do lockdowns again. Normally, it's felt that the incubation period for this virus is about 2 weeks. So there's evidence that with these new surges, 70,000 a day for a week, that in a couple of weeks, or 3 weeks if you consider hospitalizations, there could be a spike in deaths. Do you think this country might be heading towards lockdowns again, which have proven to be very unpopular?
Yeah, without a doubt. We're in the fire now, and here's why. We had a situation where things calmed down, but we knew that they would once the doctors and scientists learned more about the virus, and we got the hospitalization situation under control and testing moved forward. But the problem that has pretty much people's COVID fatigue. People had just gotten tired of following the rules. And this is something that we Americans typically have had problems with throughout history, is following rules. And this is the situation we're facing now, because the one good thing about where we are now is that we're not starting from scratch, not knowing anything about this virus and not knowing how it's going to spread or transmit. But we're in almost a worse situation because we know how it goes, and some people have gotten complacent and comfortable with masks. It's actually interesting when you go into some places now, they have these rules about how many people can fit in an elevator. You shouldn't be surprised to see more than double that amount in the elevator. And I've seen it several times myself and declined to get into that elevator. But that's the big part of the problem. We're headed towards lockdowns again because, one, of people just being tired of following the rules, and two, there's this big confrontation between politics and science right now, which is not good for any part of the country.
Absolutely correct. I think it's time probably to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. And our moderator is Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal.
And we just have a few minutes left, and I didn't want to leave without talking about a singular achievement for President Trump, whether you like it or not. The country seems to be divided as well, but the Senate confirmed his nomination to the Supreme Court of Judge, now Justice Amy Coney Barrett of Indiana. She's very conservative. This is a popular confirmation with conservatives and many Republicans, not so much at all for Democrats who think she's just too far to the right. The real question that I have, Linda, in the final days of this election, is there any sense that this is helping President Trump in this election, or is it kind of too little too late?
I think it helps him with the people who were already going to vote for him. It helps him with religious conservatives who are hopeful that she will vote to overturn the right to abortion when a relevant case comes before the court. It may be a question of converting people who didn't vote last time into voters this time. So I don't think anybody's mind has changed about Donald Trump. It's just a question of motivation and turnout. Who was inspired to turn out this time? You know, another thing I should say about the Supreme Court is that they did, in recent days, leave in place two decisions in lower courts that are involving battleground states. And went against the Republican position to block ballot receipt extensions. So there's a lot of legal wrangling going on right now over whether to extend the deadline to receive ballots after Election Day. And Republicans believe this is wrong. They think that the statutes in place should be followed. And Amy Coney Barrett did not participate in those cases, even though she was already on the court, because she had just joined the court and didn't have time to read up on those cases. But what this does is ensure that we're going to have litigation following the election, and it could delay knowing the result.
That, Linda, is an understatement. JJ, do you think that this is a political question, so I don't want to pose it to you, but I'm just curious as to whether you think that Barrett's nomination resonates with any others other than the president's political base.
Well, Tom, the Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett is now a member of the court, and it is awful difficult to say how she votes moving forward. We know what we think or what we've been told. We know what's likely. But if we think back throughout history, there have been more than one Supreme Court justice that did not vote the way people thought they would, that over time they changed the way they thought about things. And I don't know that this Supreme Court justice will be any different. What I do know is that we as a nation have to embrace laws, our rules, and our norms. And when we start not being willing to accept things that we don't like, but that are lawful, that's a path that creates bigger problems for the country. So there are going to be people that like what she says and how she does her work, and there are going to be people who don't. But I do think at the end of the day, what has to be important to everyone is to realize that we need to move on, regardless of who's put in positions and who's elected. But we need to move on and to make sure that we do everything that's necessary to make sure that the country as a whole stays strong. And I think people are willing to do that.
Well and eloquently spoken, JJ. I couldn't agree more. Finally, with a few more minutes, I want to talk about this new episode of racial unrest. Many of our listeners have known that over the spring and early fall, there have been many instances of racial discord, protests, not all racial, but some racial, a lot of questions about law and order in places like Portland, Oregon, the state of Wisconsin, and several places, and now in Philadelphia. In many of these cases, there are instances of a black man being wounded or black man or woman being killed. There was another one in Kentucky earlier this year. President Trump has tried to make this an issue of law and order, an issue that he had hoped would resonate with people. There has been a lot of anger in the streets. There was a rise in the so-called Black Lives Matter movement, but that ebbed and flowed. Linda, what is your sense of whether all of this, which is clearly unhelpful and difficult and in some cases very disturbing. Is any of this resonating in this election? How big of a cutting issue is it, or is it?
Well, it is a factor, but again, like many elements of this race, it could cut both ways. So you have the shooting of Black men and women, the killing at the hands of police of Black men and women, which inflames the entire country. It isn't just Black people who are upset about this. I mean, I think all people of humanity and compassion think it's terrible. When, you know, in the case in Philadelphia, it was a man with mental problems. He was brandishing a knife. He was shot and killed. You know, and then that leads to unrest, not only in Philadelphia, but also I think in Brooklyn, there was also protests. Sometimes you end up with larger street violence. You get looting. You get just essentially lawlessness. So Donald Trump's gamble is that the lawlessness will frighten people in the suburbs, suburban women in particular. And he's doing terribly with suburban women. We're going to have the biggest gender gap, I think, in the history of gender gaps in this election. Women do not like Donald Trump to a much greater degree than men. Donald Trump thinks that scaring women with visions of urban unrest is going to make them vote for him. I mean, that may be true in some cases. I don't think it's going to work. But for Joe Biden, I think he's a reassuring figure. He's civil. He doesn't speak in, you know, these awful negative ways that, you know, if you're talking about women and they have their children listening to the president, they don't want their children to listen to Donald Trump because he's rude and profane. Ultimately, I don't know that these episodes of urban unrest are going to help Donald Trump in any way.
I should just interject here a short anecdote. I have a friend who's a member of his family is a woman who's running for the House of Representatives. And I called him the other day to ask how she's doing. And he said, look, it's very simple. Women in this district hate Trump. Mm-hmm. They like his policies, mm-hmm. but they hate him. And we're going to have to run 6 or 7 points better than President Trump to have a chance to win this election. That's how polarizing he is yeah. with women. Mm-hmm. And that is not an isolated situation. JJ, tell us about the possibility that foreign actors are exploiting this unrest, this civil unrest, in a way to throw some turmoil into this whole situation at the end.
Well, Tom, again, thank you for the question. But to be brief about it, it's very obvious. When you look at what's taken place in the last few weeks where people have gotten emails, where people have gotten text and robocalls from someone or some organization saying, vote Trump or else, we're coming after you. We will know how you voted. This is clearly the work of a foreign actor because no American that actually knows how the voting process works in the U.S. is going to try to pull that because there is no way that anyone can tell how you voted when you step into a voting booth except that you tell them. There is no way for any group, whether it's an extremist group on the right or the left, to know how you voted. So to take that approach and to have the resources to reach out to so many different people, it's all about a hack. It's all about foreign actors' power, their skill sets, their sophistication. And this tells you just how important this election is to people who actually reside in those circles. So there's a lot of that going on. It's not new. It's going to continue. But I do think Americans now understand a lot better how this works than we did in 2016.
Well, let us hope so. For the sake of democracy, for the sake of humanity, for the sake of interpersonal relations, for the sake of all of us, let us hope that is the case. I think you're right, and I certainly hope so. That's all the time we have. Thank you again for Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP, and host of Target USA. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Tom DeFrank.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this special edition of the program, we feature two distinguished female members of Congress who have both chosen not to run for re-election this year. The Congressional Research Service reports that out of the 535 members of the lower and upper chambers of Congress, 131, or more than 25%, are women. A larger number of these female lawmakers, 105, are Democrats. 22 are registered Republicans. Women have been running for office and getting elected in record numbers. We are likely to see that trend continue in the 2020 cycle. Our first guest is Congresswoman Nita Lowey, a Democrat from the state of New York, currently chairwoman of the powerful Appropriations Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives. Congresswoman Nita Lowey has been representing New York's 17th congressional district for more than 30 years. She represents parts of Westchester and Rockland counties, an area in the Hudson Valley just north of New York City. Since she was elected to Congress in 1988, Congresswoman Lowey has assumed key leadership roles in the Democratic caucus. She was the first woman and the first New Yorker to chair the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. She is also the first woman to chair the House Appropriations Committee. Throughout her legislative career, Congresswoman Lowey has been a leading proponent of educational opportunity, health care, homeland security preparedness, women's issues, a leading international role for the United States, and national security. She has also chaired the Subcommittee on State, Foreign Operations, and Related Programs, which is under the Appropriations Committee. In her farewell speech to her committee colleagues, she said, quote, "Do not succumb to the pervasive partisanship that permeates what can feel like all aspects of our professional and sometimes our personal lives," close quote. We'll talk with Congresswoman Lowey about her role as chairwoman of the Appropriations Committee, the issues to which she is dedicated, her lifelong commitment to bipartisanship, and what she believes is at stake in the upcoming elections. Congresswoman Nita Lowey joins us via Microsoft Teams. Congresswoman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to have a chance to talk with you.
Congresswoman, why did you decide to retire after more than 30 years of distinguished service as a member of Congress?
Well, let me say, in 32 years, I have had the most extraordinary experience. I've accomplished a great deal, and I think it's time. It's as simple as that. And I should say, I love the job. I love what I'm doing. I had an opportunity to interact with so many great members. I am retiring as the chair of the Appropriations Committee. And this was, of course, a great honor.
Speaking of the Appropriations Committee, Congresswoman Lowey, I'm not sure that our vast audience grasps the power of your committee. Briefly explain as plainly as possible why we always use the word powerful before the word Appropriations Committee.
Certainly, it's very clear that if you're chair of Appropriations, you're in charge of all the money, $1.4 trillion, and give or take a little bit here and there. And we make the decisions as to how we spend the money. I work with my colleagues. We have very, very committed, outstanding members on this committee. And when it comes to the funding, we make these decisions. And I do think how you spend your money is really an understanding of our values. So I work very hard, and we make, I think, decisions that make life better for people all across the country and internationally around the world.
And speaking of values, as chairwoman of the committee, what types of programs and priorities have you championed?
As you know, the Appropriations Committee has 12 subcommittees. I serve on the Foreign Ops Appropriation Committee, but of course, I have a voice in every one of the subcommittees. But I'll talk about that for a minute because I know it's important to you. I have been a strong advocate for international education for women and girls. This has been critical as I've traveled to many countries, and you see how important it is to give our girls the tools so that they can stand taller and they can be their own people. I remember another incident which was very critical. We are in charge of the research budget at the National Institutes of Health, and I made sure that we were promoting gender parity because at that time, even the lab rats were male. I often talk about that because we had to make sure that funding at the NIH provided investment in women's health, women's research, women's funding.
That's extraordinary. Well, another very important topic, particularly this year, is, of course, COVID relief. And we know that the democratically controlled House of Representatives has championed that relief. But I wonder how disappointed you may be now that there's still a bottleneck that the Senate, the White House, have not yet come to an agreement as we are seeing cases on the rise and businesses needing relief, individuals needing relief. What is your view on that?
Well, first of all, the Senate must pass the updated HEROES Act because what it will do is support American families, address the health and economic crises that coronavirus has caused. I led the House in passing a $3 trillion relief package in May. And when the President and Senate didn't even come to the table, we passed a scaled back version in September. Even as the needs have grown and still the Republicans won't work with us, especially on testing in a meaningful way, our local heroes depend on this assistance. Our state and local governments can't possibly continue to keep police, firefighters, EMTs, teachers, and more on the job without raising taxes if we don't help them recover some lost revenue from the COVID crisis. So we need to pass another relief package for American families as soon as possible. And I'm very proud of Speaker Nancy Pelosi. We came to the Congress in the same time. We've worked very closely together. And just because I'm retiring, it doesn't mean I'm slowing down. We are working very hard trying to get these appropriation bills passed by the Senate, signed into law for FY 2021. And I'm still fighting for the district, and I won't stop doing that anytime soon.
Is there still time, Congresswoman Lowy, to pass the bill before the election, or do you foresee it possibly being passed after the election in the lame duck session?
Yes, I don't think there's much time now. Let me just say the election is very soon, and there's no time to pass it before. We could have done it if the president and Mitch McConnell in the Senate was serious. The Republicans continued to obstruct our progress, and we will, I am sure, get a good bill passed by the end of the year.
Congresswoman Lowy, perhaps the Republicans in the Senate were not serious about COVID relief before the election, but they certainly were very serious about confirming a new Supreme Court justice to replace deceased Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a liberal icon on the court. I wonder how disappointed you may have been that they made this a higher priority than taking up COVID relief.
I have many questions about decisions made by Mitch McConnell and the others in leadership and in the White House. So you can see where Leader McConnell's priorities are. I think we have got to work together to make sure we pass a good bill. And even if it happens after the election, we'll get something good done.
Speaking of that, working in a bipartisan way, I think that has really also been a hallmark of your career. And I quote you in your farewell speech to your colleagues that you made in July. You said, quote, "My parting request to you is this: do not succumb to the pervasive partisanship that permeates what can feel like all aspects of our professional and sometimes our personal lives." And that struck me because, again, you're an appropriator. You get down to business, and yet you're a strong and very proud Democrat. So it's an interesting and a very laudable combination. I wonder if you could reflect over the years, particularly to what extent maybe Republicans during the Trump years are either less prone to cooperate. I mean, how do Republicans during these years contrast with previous Republican administrations in terms of cooperation?
Certainly think there was better cooperation in past years. I worked very closely with President Bush, both the father and the son, by the way. I think it's important to mention, as appropriators, we have to pass our bills. If we don't pass our bills, the government shuts down. So we've always worked in a bipartisan way. That doesn't mean we agree on everything. But at the end of the year, I talk with Senator Shelby, and we get the job done. And I have an excellent relationship with Congresswoman Granger as well.
Congresswoman Granger is the ranking member on the Appropriations Committee in the House of Representatives. And Senator Shelby, because the Senate is in the hands of the Republicans, he is your counterpart on the Senate Appropriations Committee, correct?
Correct. And I work very well with Kay Granger, and I work very well with Senator Shelby. But I think it's important to know that neither of them really are independent, because they are closely following the directives that come from the White House. And that has made a big difference. But we have excellent relationships, and we usually get the work done. And whether it's Senator Shelby speaking to the president and working with Kay Granger, we usually get a good bipartisan package coming out of the Appropriations Committee. I'm proud of our work.
Congresswoman Loy, I want to now turn to other issues which you champion: health care, women's rights, voting rights. And I'm wondering to what extent you're worried about the new Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett. She's a very conservative justice. That would make her the sixth conservative justice on the Supreme Court, basically shifting the direction of the court into a solidly conservative direction, which some analysts say could jeopardize, for example, the Affordable Care Act, a woman's right to an abortion, which is guaranteed under Roe v. Wade, even voting rights. To what extent does this appointment, and as we are about to enter an election and as we are all voting, to what extent does that upset you or concern you?
I am very concerned that this Supreme Court might reverse landmark decisions that protect fundamental rights in our society. And that's why it's so important that we elect Joe Biden, because we need him to provide direction and take us where we need to be.
Well, that certainly leads me to ask you about the election. What's at stake in your view? And what would you like to see as the outcome? What are, in your view, the major domestic and foreign policy priorities? And are you optimistic that even Democrats could not just hold the House of Representatives, but perhaps, as analysts say, be the majority in the Senate?
Well, I think it is an unprecedented moment. And this election is about who we want to be as a country. Should we continue to work for a more equitable society? Should we continue to fight climate change? Should we continue to guarantee health care as a basic human right and pass common sense gun control measures? The United States has always been respected around the world as a leader, standing up for the most vulnerable, standing up to dictators and bad actors. Do we want to continue to be the beacon of hope and freedom for the world and protect and preserve the American ideal of liberty and justice for all? No matter the outcome of this election, I have been inspired to see so many young people, not just in my district, but around the country, speaking up. Progress is achieved when you use your voice and advocate for yourself and your neighbors. And that is an inspiration to young people around the world. So I have faith that the Biden-Harris administration will make progress on all of these priorities and will help make America a more prosperous, more just, and more equitable society. I am cautiously optimistic that we can flip the Senate and even expand our majority in the House.
Congresswoman Nita Lowey is a Democrat from the state of New York. She is the chairwoman of the powerful House of Representatives Appropriations Committee. Congresswoman Lowey, thank you so much for your time and your insights, and we wish you the very best.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure having an opportunity to talk with you.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. Here's a shout out to a loyal Twitter fan and listener whose Twitter handle is Mario585 from Kenya. Mario, thanks for your feedback on our recent Afghan show. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now we are delighted to pivot to another female member of Congress, Susan Brooks, a Republican representing the 5th District in Indiana. Congresswoman Brooks was elected to Congress in 2012 and serves on the Energy and Commerce Committee and the House Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress. We'll be talking with the outgoing Congresswoman about her legislative achievements, her positions on issues such as combating the coronavirus pandemic, efforts to recruit more Republican women to run for office, and what she sees as what's at stake in the upcoming elections. Congresswoman Brooks joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
It's my pleasure to be here, Carol, and hello to all your listeners.
Congresswoman Brooks, notwithstanding your imminent departure from Congress, what prompted you to run for your seat to begin with almost 10 years ago?
I'm one of those members that actually was asked to run for office. Some younger men in the Republican Party reached out to me. I was senior vice president at our state's community college system and general counsel, and they called me and asked me to consider running. And I jumped into a very crowded primary. I had never run for office before. I had served in other public offices, but had been appointed as U.S. attorney under President Bush and as a deputy mayor under Mayor Steve Goldsmith in Indianapolis. But I had never put my name on a ballot before. And I was quite frankly very frustrated at the dysfunction in Congress, at the lack of bipartisanship and the lack of what I thought were really important things getting done for the American people. So that's why I decided to jump in and run.
Wonderful. Well, now you're leaving us. Talk about what you think you have accomplished over these years as a member of Congress. In what areas do you believe you have made a difference?
Members, I think, typically focus on the legislation, but I don't think we can ever underestimate the important work we do on behalf of constituents who have had issues with federal government, whether those are veterans dealing with the Veterans Administration or constituents dealing with Social Security or the IRS. We work on foreign adoption issues. Those are probably the most meaningful types of work that we do. But when it comes to legislation, I partnered with Anna Eshoo of California, and we got the Pandemic All Hazard Preparedness Act. So believe it or not, I've been involved in biodefense issues and pandemic issues long before this pandemic struck. We got that bill reauthorized with increased funding back in June of 2019. I also worked on mental health with law enforcement issues, and now with law enforcement really being under siege, trying to make sure that law enforcement not only have a better understanding of mental health, but that they also receive mental health assistance. Worked on the opioid crisis, something that really gripped the country and has the addictions issues. So very involved in opioid and mental health legislation. And then I also chaired the House Ethics Committee during the Me Too movement, when a lot of members had been accused of sexual harassment in the workplace or their staffs. And that was a very difficult time for the country. But we also were able to work with other members to get some of that legislation passed as to how those matters are handled in the House. To wrap up my time in Congress, I'm very proud to be on a significant bipartisan committee, the Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress. And that is to try to find ways. We came up with 97 recommendations to improve and modernize Congress. So I'm really proud to be going out with that work just finishing up.
an impressive array of issues that you've worked on. I wonder if you could just give us one example of one of those 97 ways to improve Congress.
Believe it or not, there are so many ways, but one of the things that I really focused on was civility and the fact that we need to really impress upon new members the importance of civility, the importance of bipartisanship as a way to move legislation forward. And so we recommended that there be more focus on it during new member orientation, which will be taking place soon after this election is over. But we also talked about the importance of having bipartisan retreats of committees. Our work is so partisan, even the manner in which our committee hearings and the manner in which the House is set up is very partisan. People sit on separate sides of the aisle. You know, when they say reach across the aisle, there really are aisles that you literally have to reach across to work with other members. And so we talked and came up with several ideas, more ways to improve the civility in the House and bipartisanship. That's just one, but I think it's a critically important issue. And if honestly, we can do a better job with that, then so many of the other recommendations will fall into place as well, like improving the budget process, improving the technology in the House, accessibility of citizenry to what we're doing. There are just many things, but I think if we can improve civility and bipartisanship, that'll go a long way towards solving a lot of other problems.
In our conversation with Congresswoman Nita Lowey, she mentioned the same thing, the importance of bipartisanship. She underscores that. It didn't used to be that way. Democrats and Republicans were able, it seems, to find more points of convergence and consensus on a number of pressing issues.
Well, I hope that the electorate begins to reward those members and return those members to Congress who do value and emphasize bipartisanship. Unfortunately, the polarization, I think, happens in large part because the media pays a lot more attention to those people on the far right and far left of both of our parties. Far less attention is paid to those folks that move more toward the middle or that get a lot of bipartisan work done.
Absolutely. And I wanted to refer to your tenure on the Homeland Security Committee several years ago. You chaired the Subcommittee on Emergency Preparedness, Response, and Communications. Given your background, how would you characterize the U.S. response to the coronavirus pandemic, for which President Trump has been widely criticized for what is perceived of as a mishandling of it from day one? He himself admitted that he did know about the lethality, the severity of the novel virus, but didn't want to cause panic. Do you think the White House could have done better? And maybe should have had a more vigorous coordinating role?
Well, I do think that it is important that leaders not cause panic. And so I do agree with him that he did not want to create significant alarm. And obviously, because this was a novel virus, I think the most important things he did was truly ensure that the innovative scientific companies that we have, the pharmaceutical, the diagnostic, the supply chain that we needed to address this pandemic, that there were not barriers standing in their way. That the FDA, HHS, that all of the agencies that were working on this would work lockstep to try to move as fast as they could to bring as many therapeutics and vaccines and diagnostic tests to market and to help the American people. I think what is so difficult, we've not seen a pandemic in over 100 years. And I would say that the states were certainly not prepared for it. And because of the manner in which the federal government works with state governments, the federal government did not tell all of the states how to do things in a very prescriptive way. The president chose to leave a lot of the decisions to the governors and to the states because the outbreaks were happening in such different ways all across the country. So I think it was a very difficult thing. Hindsight is always 20/20. I think we can always say that we can always do better. And that is what everyone is doing. Congress is looking at ways to improve, for instance, our strategic national stockpile. We learned about our tremendous reliance on China for our entire supply chain of PPE. We learned about our dependence on foreign suppliers, and we need now to be really onshoring or reshoring much more of that domestically. So we have just so much to learn, and that's what we have to focus on. We must continue to focus on funding public health infrastructure. I think our states have not done that sufficiently. I think the federal government has not done that sufficiently. I think now is the time that we will really focus on making sure that our public health infrastructure is funded at a much higher level.
I'd like to turn briefly to the Supreme Court. In the wake of the death of Liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as you know, President Trump nominated, and she has now been confirmed, Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. Now she's the sixth conservative on the nine-member court, likely shifting its ideological direction for many decades to come. What's your position on her ascension to the Supreme Court, Congresswoman Brooks?
I am a big fan and a supporter of now Justice Amy Coney Barrett. And she was a well-regarded Notre Dame law professor. So the Hoosier State does claim her, even though was born and raised in New Orleans. But obviously her ties here in the Hoosier State that I represent are deep. Her legal background was impeccable. And I thought that her answers during the confirmation hearing were warm. They were intelligent. All confirmations, I think, are incredibly difficult. But I think she comes to the bench with tremendous background, having clerked for the court. But also, I loved how she weaved in her answers when it came to her own family. I love that as a mother, she will be the first mother to serve on the court with school-age children. I think that's very important. And it, in many ways, it modernizes the court. And while, yes, ideologically, she may be very different from Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she has tremendous respect for Justice Ginsburg. And I think that was evident from the time she was nominated. I think she will be not one to be making law, but interpreting law, and will be a strict constitutionalist. And I think that came through. And while, yes, the court may be leaning that way, she, I think, will be a very fair, open, and important justice for many years to come.
Let's talk about women and the role of women in Congress and your current efforts to recruit more Republicans to run for office. Because although there are many more women in office now than in any other year, the majority still identify as Democrats. So what are you doing specifically to recruit more Republican women?
Well, thank you, Carol, for that question. I'm very, very proud of the efforts. I think the 2018 election cycle was a really significant wake-up call for my party. We lost several wonderful incumbent Republican women, and the party and leadership of our party said that our conference in the House needed to really reflect the diversity and the opinions of the American people. And we have 228 women to run as Republicans, 94 of those women made it through their primaries and are on the general election ballot this coming Tuesday. We actually have 76 people of color, minority candidates, on the general election ballot. Again, shattering records. We also have more veterans than we've ever had on the ballot. So I hope that we'll have a much more balanced 117th Congress with a lot more Republican women.
Well, we'll certainly keep an eye out for that after the elections. Look, Americans have a stark choice between Democratic nominee former Vice President Joe Biden and Republican standard bearer U.S. President Donald Trump. Congresswoman Brooks, what do you believe are the fundamental stakes in the upcoming presidential and congressional elections?
I do believe before this pandemic, our economy was booming. Unemployment was at historic lows. And that is the absolute, I think, top priority of the Trump administration, is getting the virus under control and getting the economy back again. We have to find a way to do it safely. We have to find a way to ensure that people are working. Because if people are not working, the homelessness issue in our country will skyrocket. Issues around hunger will multiply. People losing their jobs. We've got to get not only the virus under control, but find a way back to work even while the virus is still going on. I think that is the big issue. And I am concerned that under President Biden, things will slow down. The economy will slow. Regulations and rules will be more significant, and that we will have a much slower time to recovery. And I think we are in this for some time to come yet.
Congresswoman Susan Brooks is a Republican from the Midwestern state of Indiana. Congresswoman, thank you so much for your time and terrific insights on all of these critical issues. And we wish you the very best in your future endeavors.
Thank you, Carol. Stay well, stay healthy.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. At least 10 people.